The following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Exelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Campaign controversies, Romney on the poor, Newt's non-concession, and surprising job news.
Afghan endgames, attacks from friends, talking with enemies, recalculating retreat.
Risks around the world, from the power brokers in Davos, the Eurozone summit in Brussels, Washington, and beyond.
Red Tails Remembered, one of the legendary black Tuskegee Airmen of World War II on the new George Lucas movie about them. And the reality.
I'll Take Romance. That's the new CD from music veteran Steve Tyrell, thanks in part to former President Bill Clinton.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only. A production of GateWave Incorporated, the nonprofit 24/7 radio reading service for those with disabilities. For the week of February 5th in the Super Bowl, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Exelberth.
We're going to have people power defeat money power in the next 6 months.
I'm not concerned about the very poor. We have a safety net there. If it needs a repair, I'll fix it.
The economy is growing stronger. The recovery is speeding up. And we've got to do everything in our power to keep it going.
The presidential campaign last week had its share of the expected and unexpected. Given Newt Gingrich's self-proclaimed grandiosity, it was perhaps not surprising that he never actually conceded his Florida trouncing by Mitt Romney, either in his election night appearance or a usual congratulatory phone call. Typically, too, Mitt Romney shadowed his own victory and leading poll positions in Nevada, Arizona, Michigan, with an insensitive phrasing of his prime focus on the middle class, for which he later had to apologize.
The real surprise of the week, especially for President Obama, came in a Friday Labor Department report that employment in January grew by the fastest pace in 9 months, with 243,000 new non-farm jobs driving unemployment down to 8.3%, the lowest in 3 years. To analyze the fallout from Florida for Romney, Gingrich, trailing contenders Rick Santorum and Ron Paul, and to characterize the campaign ahead for your ears only, we're joined again by TV commentator Eleanor Clift, also a Newsweek Daily Beast contributor. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be with you.
Did the media make too much of the Romney remark, or does it say something real about his multimillionaire's worldview following his infamous $10,000 debate bet, his remarks about liking to fire people, though he did mean insurance companies, and being jobless himself?
Well, the media makes too much of everything, but Newt Gingrich, Romney's principal opponent, also jumped on the remark. So you could hardly say that it was meaningless. If you put it in context, even you had some conservatives furious that he seemed to suggest that the safety net is a permanent part of the economy, when conservatives believe that it encourages a culture of dependency. And so he even lost among conservatives with that remark. It really kind of just shows a tone deafness as to what will play on the campaign trail. If you're a very wealthy person, you don't want to be seen as out of touch. These kind of remarks just add to the notion that he really doesn't understand the lives of ordinary people. So I think it's quite damaging, especially when taken in the context of all the other comments that you mentioned.
Turning to Gingrich, if he lost to a man he calls a Massachusetts moderate among Florida's mostly conservative Republicans, what are his best chances going forward?
Well, I think Gingrich is still hoping that the dissatisfaction with Romney as the party's nominee will somehow spark a revival of the passion that he saw in South Carolina for his candidacy. And the fact that Donald Trump apparently this week was negotiating with both political camps for his endorsement, and the Romney people took it, even though the optics of it weren't very good for Romney. I think they were afraid that if Trump endorsed Gingrich, that might start a domino with Sarah Palin and perhaps some of the other noted conservatives jumping on the Gingrich bandwagon. And so Romney really wanted to head that off. And so I think, you know, Gingrich right now, it doesn't look like he has the fire beneath his candidacy that was there earlier.
Have you ever witnessed the Republican establishment turn as openly against one of its former members as it did against Gingrich before Florida?
And it was quite amazing. And it was people who worked with Gingrich and who know Gingrich and were fearful that if he should lead the ticket in November, that it would not only spell a catastrophic loss at the presidential level, but that he would take down everybody else with him. He's just too mercurial and has just too much baggage for the Democrats to exploit. So they joined with Romney, who spent, I think, $15 million in Florida to essentially defeat Gingrich with all those negative ads.
Well, Gingrich did get $10 million from the Adelson Cansino family in Nevada. Does it look like he has more coming for them? And if he doesn't, what fumes does he run on to get to the convention and, you know, hope for some delegates and an ability to bargain over some influence?
You're right. Gingrich was outspent, though, 5-1 even in Florida, even with the money from the Las Vegas casino magnate. And I assume that Adelson has, Sheldon Adelson is his name, that he has funded Gingrich for the Nevada caucuses. But I think at some point he's not going to want to throw good money after bad if Gingrich looks like he can't perform, you know, without the Adelson money. I think that's not going to be enough.
Last week's economic trends could always turn negative given problems in Europe, threats from Iran to oil supplies, the Middle East, U.S. interests at home and abroad. But while signs of recovery hold, do Republicans lose leverage on the campaign trail and Capitol Hill?
Well, it was really interesting watching everybody trying to find the bad news in this month's job numbers. I think for the first time you actually had a report that was just unquestionably a good one, and that does kind of interfere with the Republican message. But Mitt Romney is now saying that his campaign is not just about jobs, and also that if he were president and Obama's policies weren't in place, the recovery would have happened faster and would have been stronger. But I think it really does subtract from the Republican argument if the economy does show signs of serious strength and is turning around by the time of the election. And I think conservatives are also worried that with Romney, he can't run against Obamacare either, because he instituted his own plan, RomneyCare, in the state of Massachusetts. And so they're wondering, well, what would they run on? We talked about that on the McLaughlin Group this week, and Pat Buchanan said, don't worry, Eleanor, we'll make something up. I'm sure they will. There'll always be divisions.
What was your reaction to the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation's decision to cut funding for health care by Planned Parenthood based on a congressional investigation of whether tax dollars support its abortion services, then the widespread outcry and that quick about-face?
Well, I think we've learned that the Komen Foundation does have some higher-ups who are strongly opposed to abortion rights, and Planned Parenthood does perform abortions. But I think, to be fair, I think Komen was looking to avoid controversy because they saw that Planned Parenthood had become very controversial over the past year. You have Newt Gingrich is running on a pledge to defund it if he became president. So I think they thought if they backed away from Planned Parenthood, they would be stepping out of controversy. They did just the reverse. And a lot of women in this country have gotten services to Planned Parenthood, a lot of young women, a lot of poor women. And the reaction was really overwhelming. And Mayor Bloomberg of New York, you know, wrote a check for $250,000. And so Komen did reverse its position. But I think they've suffered a lot of damage. They look now way too political for an organization that everybody thought was devoted to women's health.
TV commentator Eleanor Clift is also a Newsweek Daily Beast contributor. Her books include 2 Weeks of Life, a memoir of love, death, and politics, Founding Sisters and the 19th Amendment, and Madam President, Shattering the Last Glass Ceiling.
Quote from the news, protecting your privacy. That was the headline on one of a series of full-page newspaper ads by Microsoft playing off a congressional investigation of new Google policies that may make too much personal information and online activity available to advertisers. And here's another. We don't build services to make money. We make money to build better services, to make the world more open and connected. That was Facebook creator Mark Zuckerberg in a letter to potential investors as his social media giant launched filings for an initial public offering that aimed to raise $5 billion. The new Facebook timeline feature also has raised privacy issues.
Next, Afghan Endgames, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. A first step towards true democracy. That was Zhu Jianwan, a resident of the southern Chinese village of Wukan, where only 2 months ago villagers staged a bold protest against official corruption and chased away local leaders. Last week, the villagers voted for a committee to supervise future elections. Now this.
I don't think these claims are new. These claims have been made for many, many years. And we all know the reasons for that, because we had a common agenda with most of the other players in the world many, many years back, and that doesn't seem to be leaving us in terms of its effect.
While we can't completely eliminate the potential for insider threats, we can greatly reduce them by using a multi-layered approach that includes smart vetting procedures, cultural training, leader and soldier force protection awareness, and counterintelligence efforts.
Pakistan's Foreign Minister Hina Rabbani Kaur came to Kabul last week, a gesture of solidarity, but with confusing denials of recent Taliban POW claims of support from Islamabad. And on Capitol Hill, U.S. Brigadier General Stephen Townsend had to explain the military's response to mounting losses inflicted by the very Afghan government forces that U.S. and NATO troops are fighting with and training. So many Americans were at least partially relieved to hear Defense Secretary Leon Panetta suggest that the U.S. combat role in Afghanistan would be scaled back to training only in 2013, a year before their scheduled exit.
France has already talked about withdrawing early after losing troops to Afghan allies, and the U.S. is pursuing talks about talking with representatives of the Taliban leadership, even as the fight with their foot soldiers goes on. With some thoughts about possible strategies in Afghanistan and in Iraq, where U.S. troops have already left, for your ears only, we're joined again by Dr. Thomas Henriksen, senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution and the U.S. Joint Special Operations University, for which he's written about the policy he calls WHAM, Winning Hearts and Minds, in Afghanistan and elsewhere. Welcome back to our program.
Good morning.
First, let's talk about what's happening on the ground in and around Afghanistan. What prospects do you see for talks with the Taliban that would bring them back into government and end or greatly reduce insurgent violence, small unit attacks, suicide bombings?
Well, I think the Taliban might come into talks with us, but there's going to be many problems, of course, with the Karzai government that feels it's being sidelined in these talks, and it wants its own separate talks. Additionally, there's a feeling among some of the Taliban that the talks are somewhat a cover, that they're going to take over anyway, that the United States is leaving. So we have to, the United States, that is, has to, in fact, fight that feeling that we're pulling out too quickly, and the Afghans will not be able to defend themselves. So there are a lot of sort of pieces to this puzzle that have to be put together. So just because there's talks beginning, it's not, in fact, clear how it's going to end.
Do you see Afghan President Hamid Karzai really going along with a Taliban presence in his government or in particular regions?
Well, he said in the past that, you know, there's room for everyone in this government, but by that he means that the Taliban must lay down their arms and join his government. So it's going to be very difficult for him to, in fact, see them part of a government, and it will awaken certain splits within the country itself, because the Taliban are largely, but not exclusively, part of the Pashtun people in the south, and that leaves other ethnic groups wondering. So it's not just Taliban versus Karzai, it's Taliban versus other ethnic communities and in a very fractured society.
How worried are you by the mounting toll on allied forces, by the government troops with which they're working? And do you see it as Taliban or al-Qaeda infiltration, inspiration, or a more basic clash of cultures between supposed allies?
The so-called green on green is where the military phrases that, the military being blue, but these attacks being among ourselves. They're quite worrisome because I think they undermine certain morale among the soldiers and Marines and NATO forces themselves, that who they can trust and who they can work with. Now, many of the attacks have been personal grudges, not just infiltration of a Taliban or a Taliban wearing uniforms. But there again, it does lead to certain uncertainty. And the French were certainly taken back when four of their soldiers were killed a few weeks ago and led to the French announcing in part to their withdrawal in 2013. So it is a problem. And it's not easy to manage. It's one that the United States and its NATO allies have to work on, but it's not clear again whether it can be stopped.
In your essay on winning hearts and minds, you note it has long been a useful tactic in war zones, but that, as currently practiced by Washington, it's more like nation building and just too expensive to endure. Give us some numbers.
Well, that is true. I mean, the very fact that we're spending billions of dollars in Afghanistan, roughly $100 billion a year, and the total cost of the war is soon going to approach that of Iraq, it's terribly expensive. The hearts and mind concept, briefly, is that you win over people to your side, and not only do you win them over to your side, but they connect them to their government. That's the vital part that most people leave out. It's not just that Americans are considered good guys in a war zone, but they can somehow connect these people in villages and rural areas to their own government. That's extremely tough to do. It sounds easy, but it's very, very hard to do. And that is a key ingredient, not just infrastructure building of highways and hospitals and police academies and so on.
Well, it depends on the nature of the government itself, and we've many times expressed doubts about Karzai and who he's really working with and for besides himself.
Absolutely. If a government is distrusted or is considered corrupt or whimsical or considered, in fact, an enemy of the people in the village, that breaks that vital link that has to be established between people and their government. And that is a worrisome factor, as you indicated, with Karzai, and it's been so for quite some time.
The administration is downplaying Panetta's remarks about pulling back from combat a year before total pullout. What's your view?
Well, I think the United States has already turned over certain areas to local commanders, particularly in the north where it's safer, and that will continue. It's going to be a trial and error process. I think it's hard to lay down markers and say, yes, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. It's going to be hard. We're going to have to try to stand up an army that can fight, has the confidence, and also has the coherence and logistical support to fight the Taliban. That is not easy. It's not just a question of lack of bravery. It's a question of organization. And so there'll be some mistakes made as we go forward in this process, but it's clear that the United States and its allies have announced that they're going to pull out by 2014, so the process has to begin.
You've also written that Obama withdrew troops from Iraq too soon, though many Americans may be relieved our guys are not caught up in the increasingly bloody ethnic divisions and power plays there. Or do you see GIs able to keep a lid on that?
Well, I think a fair number, they had it would have been 10 to 20,000 troops in Iraq who could have kind of, from behind the scenes, helped to the Iraqi forces in combating particularly al-Qaeda elements that are still active in the country. And I think it was a loss of leverage. My own belief is we should have perhaps put troops into Kurdistan in the north. We had a long attachment with them. The Kurds were very pro-us. There was relatively little violence against us. And I think it would have helped our leverage in the Middle East as we begin to pull out of Afghanistan.
Thomas Henriksen, Senior Fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution and the U.S. Joint Special Operations University.
Quote from the news, "Those are the real heroes." That was Angel Fernandez Chavera of mainly Hispanic St. Rose of Lima Catholic Church in East Haven, Connecticut, after about 100 Latino congregants came forward to document local police harassment and violence. Despite risks of reprisal, four officers were arrested on federal charges of conspiracy, false arrest, excessive force, and obstruction of justice. And Police Chief Leonard Gallo announced his early retirement.
Next, danger seen from Davos and Brussels for your ears only.
We're back for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. Today, Syria. Tomorrow, your country. That was Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad warning the Muslim world against intervention in the bloody opposition to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, whose forces massacred at least 200 last week. Ahmadinejad was also trying to redefine the Arab Spring as promoting Islam, not democracy. Now this.
Number one, no one is immune in the current situation. It's not just a Eurozone crisis. It's a crisis that could have collateral effects, spillover effects around the world.
In the past 2 years, we worked hard to overcome the crisis. We made considerable progress, but we are not yet at the end of the road. We must continue to bring down public debts and to stabilize the Eurozone while at the same time securing growth and jobs.
There was a familiar warning at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland last week from International Monetary Fund Managing Director Christine Lagarde and measured optimism in Brussels from European Union President Herman Van Rompuy. The Brussels meeting also produced yet another action plan to reduce the threat of financial disaster in Greece and other hard-pressed nations and many of the continent's major banking houses.
And to talk about the view from those financial peaks, for your ears only, we're pleased to welcome back Ian Bremmer, president of Eurasia Group, international risk consultants, and an active participant at the Davos Summit. Thanks for joining us again.
Happy to be with you.
You report a backstage shift in priorities by German Chancellor Angela Merkel, even more pronounced than what we've seen in public from the woman most in control of Europe's monetary lifeline and its impact on U.S. economic psychology. What's the bottom line?
Well, the bottom line is she's talking more about growth, less about austerity. They've made a lot of pressure on the southern Europeans, and they understand how difficult that's being, and they're backing off the pressure a bit. And they're also showing some willingness to compromise on just how much sovereignty will be slipped away from the core states in Europe when a fiscal compact eventually comes. So clearly, they're tipping their hand, showing that, you know, money will eventually be there, more money will be there, and less dominance from Germany, but not enough to make the markets happy.
But you say many at Davos worked hard not to seem too relieved. Why?
Well, first, they weren't in the private meetings, and secondly, because they want all the money now, and the pressure has not worked its way through. We don't have yet an agreement on fiscal compact, and until that happens, the Germans are going to be unwilling to provide, you know, sort of simply sign the check. Their greatest leverage is the day before the check actually gets signed.
What reaction did you witness to the latest moves in Brussels to shore up the Eurozone with more capital resources and budgetary discipline?
I think what we saw at the Brussels summit was greater willingness on the part of the European Central Bank to actually, show that they were willing to buy up bonds irrespective of the price. And, I mean, that does buy them more time. Look, that's where we basically are at this point, muddling through is not just a matter for 2011 in Europe, it's a matter for 2012 as well. That means that the recession in Europe will probably be larger and broader than it will otherwise be, but it also means that the Eurozone is not going to fundamentally fragment.
The greatest concern in Davos was about Iran, you say, the prospects for an Israeli air attack to cripple its nuclear program, effects of any counterstrike, or an oil cutoff by Tehran to counter a European boycott and other sanctions. Was there a consensus on the likeliest scenario?
No, there wasn't a consensus at all. What there was a lot of market worry that either the Iranians are going to provoke a strike or that the Israelis are going to go by themselves to engage in one. Part of that, the Israelis, of course, want everyone to believe that. And one thing the Israelis did quite impressively is they got everyone, whether it was Likud Party, Kadima, or Labor, to talk from the same hymn sheet, pardon the metaphor, on to what extent there's likelihood of Iranian strike. They were using the same language. They really coordinated policy. You weren't seeing them do that 6 months ago. The fact that the Israelis want us to believe that there are going to be strikes is very different from the fact that there will be strikes, of course. And at this point, I personally am skeptical, but it's possible. It's not a 0% likelihood in the next 3 to 6 months. And that is indeed a danger.
How was the Arab Spring looking in Davos, especially continued bloodshed in Syria, with no nation really ready to intervene with real force, even just language, as we saw at the United Nations this weekend?
Yeah, well, my view is that the G0, the lack of global leadership, has a greater impact in the Middle East immediately than anywhere else in the world. We're seeing that literally just today with the Russians and the Chinese now vetoing jointly a Security Council resolution, a call for some form of intervention and denunciation that would open the doors for meaningful pressure to stop Assad from what's been escalatory violence. Look, we've got a civil war in Syria right now, and certainly we don't have international leadership trying to provide stability in other parts of the Middle East. It means that fragmentation in Iraq becomes more likely. It means that we're seeing just a lot of danger across the board in all of these conflicts. This really is one of the biggest flashpoints in the world today, and it's one that at Davos, folks, right after Europe, folks were more concerned about the Middle East than anything else, more than U.S. growth, more than Chinese hard landing. That's where the focus was.
You say there was not a good word to be heard in Davos about President Obama, his economic recovery efforts and prospects for re-election, albeit you guys left before the good economic news at the end of this past week.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, more confidence that companies are going to start actually putting money into the American economy. The CEOs absolutely feel that way, but nobody likes Obama. I mean, from a CEO perspective, they don't have access to the White House. They don't really like that, and they also feel like the elections are going to see no legislation whatsoever. So that's kind of where we are.
What do you think the reaction would have been to the economic news that cheered the Democrats at the end of the week?
Oh, no, I think that reaction is positive, and I think that clearly Obama has a greater likelihood of winning right now. It's very clear that it's Obama versus Romney. Frankly, I think it's been clear for several months right now. But I wouldn't go farther than that in terms of what the implications are for 2013. Generally speaking, I think the markets right now, and particularly the CEOs, the hedge fund owners, the financiers that you see at Davos, a lot of them have been so emotionally distraught by their lack of access to the Obama White House that I think they take that to mean that you're not going to see any prospect for improved U.S. governance after a potential Obama win. I think that's emotion speaking. It's not logic. In a second Obama term with likely a Republican Senate and Republican House, you know, there's only one way for Obama to go to get any governance done, and that way is clearly going to be positive for the U.S. markets. But you can't say that at this point to most of the key business leaders from the U.S. that were attending Davos.
Ian Bremmer is president of Eurasia Group, International Risk Consultants.
Now, this quote from the news, "The military is taking revenge on us." That was a 24-year-old Egyptian demonstrator voicing the popular belief that police stood by as violence erupted at a Port Said soccer match, leaving at least 74 dead, to punish fans who had previously joined pro-democracy protests and to dramatize the need for continued army control of the country.
Next, to begin Black History Month, remembering the Red Tails, film and fact, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. "Let the chap get on with his job." That was Bill Aldridge, commander of British forces in the Falkland Islands, on complaints that posting rescue copter pilot Prince William was provocative approaching the 30th anniversary of the Falkland War. Now this.
8 German fighters or 80 still doesn't change what I think of you and your boys.
We don't care. We have a right to fight for our country, the same as every other American.
From the last plane, to the last bullet, to the last minute, to the last man, we fight!
A fitting start to Black History Month this year, the new George Lucas film Red Tails spotlights the World War II exasperation and exploits of African-American Tuskegee Airmen, specifically the pioneer pursuit and fighter pilots who finally won the crucial mission of protecting heavy bombers over Nazi-held territory in Europe and finally Berlin itself.
The film's digital magic makes old-fashioned dogfight seem something out of Lucas's Star Wars and reminds us how recently even the modest levels of racial integration we have now achieved seemed like a fantasy. Quote, "I was treated better as a prisoner than I was back home," recalls retired Red Tail Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Jefferson in a 2005 memoir titled Red Tail Captured, Red Tail Free from Fordham University Press. His name is among the movie's final credits. And to talk about Red Tails in fact and film, for your ears only, nonagenarian Alex Jefferson is on the line now. Welcome to our program, sir.
It's a pleasure. It's an honor to be here.
Remind us of the official mindset about African Americans that kept blacks from Army Air Corps cockpits before the famous Tuskegee Airmen program.
Well, there was a 1925 edict of the War College evaluation of a Negro saying he was physically unqualified, mentally unqualified. In other words, the dum-dum. And, of course, four officers that met us in World War II.
Only college graduates could enter the Tuskegee program, but the failure rate was still pretty high.
Well, we did some research. I was on a research team at Maxwell Field. We found out that our failure rate was comparable to the whites' training. 100 started out of my class, 25 graduated. Our failure rate was comparable to the whites at that time.
Why the red tails on your beautiful P-51 Mustang fighter planes?
Well, that was done because of 15th Air Force. The 15th Air Force denoted the color of our planes red. There were three other groups, three white groups. One group, the 52nd Fighter Group, was yellow tails. The 325th with checkerboard, black and yellow squares. The 31st, the other group, was red and white stripe.
So that was that each unit could be discerned from the ground whose planes they were.
That's right, air identification.
The movie makes much of the restraint imposed on the Red Tails to stay with the heavy bombers, protect them from Nazi interceptors rather than chasing their attackers or other German targets. Do you recall feeling like something like a sacrificial lamb?
All I remember was the parachute after briefing, going out of the door, and Colonel Davis standing at the door looking you dead in the eyes, saying, "Stay with the bombers. As long as we stayed with the bombers, the Germans never came in." I never shot my guns at a German fighter. But striping, that's a different story.
The Red Tails never lost a bomber they were escorting.
No. That is a myth. I was on a research team, and we searched the missing crew reports of the bombers, the bomber groups in the 15th Air Force. We calculated we lost approximately 25 to 30 bombers due to German fighters during the entire war, which is a darn good record.
And you say it helped you win respect from white American POWs when you joined them after being shot down. I mean, the people that you had helped really, really appreciated you.
I was in Stalag Luft 3, 80 miles east of Berlin on the Polish border. And a couple of days after I got there, a bomber crew came in from the 15th Air Force, saw me, ran over and said, "Good, if you Red Tails had been with us, we would have been shot down." And, of course, the reputation spread throughout the whole camp.
How were your German captors to African-American prisoners? You met one with a surprising knowledge of the places you knew back home.
Well, there was a German officer who had graduated from the University of Michigan in 1936. He went back to Germany, and they put him in charge of the anti-aircraft crew that shot me down. We have German-Americans here all the time. Let's face it, it's the way this country's run.
I didn't think there were as many old P-51 and P-40 fighter planes as we see in the movie, or were there just a few and a lot of digital copies?
That's digital. That's George Lucas. That's today, let's face it. You did a darn good job. The combat scenes were fantastic, but I've got a gripe with the rest of it. I've got a real righteous gripe with the plot and the story behind it. We'll get to that.
Well, tell me about that.
Well, number one, Colonel Davis was shown standing in the window watching the plane school take off. He was never shown flying a plane. Colonel Davis flew more than 65, he led more than 65 missions. Mm-hmm. It's out of this world that Colonel Davis would allow a drunkard, a no-good, lousy, stinking drunkard, to lead the group into combat. This is a lie. I hated to see Cuba Gooding stand around with a pipe in his mouth. He represented Spanky Roberts, the major. Spanky flew more than 100 missions. He was in charge of intelligence. I hated. He never took his hat off, even in the presence of the generals who were there. It gives the public the wrong idea and attitude of allowing a captain, an alcoholic captain, to break the rules and put a man back on flying status.
In the real world, to what degree do you see the skill and bravery of the real Red Tails helping to change minds about African-Americans in and out of military service?
Same old story. Black men have been heroes ever since the Civil War. We have fought for every war to protect this country. And heroes? Heck, we just like any other man, any others. We sacrificed, we fought. And we have to tell the right story. This movie has done great. It's opened a lot of doors. I hope he makes his $15 million back. But it, in some instances, it leaves the wrong idea and attitude about the accomplishments of Tuskegee Airmen.
Alexander Jefferson is a former school science teacher, a retired Air Force Reserve lieutenant colonel, and a veteran of the all-black Tuskegee-trained fighter pursuit squadron spotlighted in the new George Lucas film, Red Tails. His 2005 memoir is Red Tail Captured, Red Tail Free, from Fordham University Press.
And now a song from the first scene of the film, set in 1944, though in fact it wasn't recorded until a year later.
Then kiss me twice, then kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time.
Next, I'll Take Romance, old songs and a new CD from a music world veteran for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. Love, peace, and soul. That was the eloquent sign-off by Don Cornelius after each installment of his long-running Soul Train TV show that from the early 1970s gave the country a window on black music, culture, and style. Cornelius committed suicide at the age of 75 after recent years of spousal abuse charges and a difficult divorce. Now this.
Someday, when I'm awfully low, when the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight.
Ah, February, the month of romance. And how better to kick it off than with a classic from romance crooner Steve Tyrell, The Way You Look Tonight. His version from the movie remake of Father of the Bride was the song Chelsea Clinton picked for the first dance at her wedding in 2010. And that choice led to his new CD that includes it, I'll Take Romance. It's out this week.
The Grammy Award-winning vocalist has made huge contributions to the music industry as an artist, producer, songwriter, music supervisor, and performer. He's produced hits for Grammy Award-winning artists, produced music and sung for television and movies. He's in his seventh year as a Christmas season fixture at New York City's Cafe Carlyle, where he replaced the late legendary Bobby Short. And he's here with us today for Your Ears Only to talk about all that and his new CD. Steve Tyrell, welcome to our show.
Thrilled to be on.
Start by telling us how Chelsea Clinton's first wedding dance to your version of The Way You Look Tonight that led to the new CD in this interview.
Last year, I got a call in my suite to come down early. And usually when that happens, there's somebody special there, you know.
This is at the Carlyle.
At the Cafe Carlyle, right. The maitre d' Tony called me. He said, Steve, come down now. And I said, okay. And I was anxious to see who it was. And I walked in the back door of the Carlyle, of the cafe. And there was President Clinton, Chelsea, and Secretary of State, Mrs. Clinton, and Chelsea's father-in-law, I think, was there. And he went on to tell me that he had brought Chelsea because that they chose that song, my version of that song, to have their first dance. And somehow in the conversation, he said, well, you should make a wedding album or something like that. And I said, well, that's why you were the president, not singing nightclubs. That's a good idea. The next day, I called the record company on Christmas Eve and told her I had just signed with Concord. And I told the head of the company, John Burke, I said, yeah, Clinton dropped by last night, like he comes over every week or something. and said that he danced with Chelsea to that, The Way You Look Tonight, and my version. And maybe we should make a wedding album and market it to the wedding industry because my songs have been used so much. And the head of the record company said, that's a great idea.
Well, let's go back to your first great ideas. How did you first get involved in music?
Well, I started as a singer in a band in high school, and I made records, local records, in Houston, where I grew up. And some of them were hits. They were like singles, you know, and then they'd get picked up nationally. And I got to know Florence Greenberg and Jerry Wexler and Ahmet Erdogan and people like that when I was still in high school. And it led to me getting a job offer to come to New York right out of high school and go to work for Scepter Records. And at that time, Dionne Warwick, it was a great unbelievable opportunity, but they had Dionne Warwick, Bird Bacharach, and Hal David. I brought B.J. Thomas with me from Texas.
What keeps bringing you and others back to music of the 30s, 40s, 50s?
Well, I discovered it, you know, when I first started singing, the Great American Songbook had made a transition into artists like Etta James and Ray Charles and Sam Cooke and Otis Redding, Try a Little Tenderness. And those artists influenced me the most because they were the ones that were doing it when I started singing. And a lot of my buddies, like Rod Stewart, you know, he loved Sam Cooke. A lot of the English guys loved the R&B singers, rhythm and blues singers. So I got into the Great American Songbook from those people. And I was working on Father the Bride, and I asked the director what they wanted the you know, what kind of music they wanted at their reception. And they didn't know, because it could have been like a disco band. It could have been anything. It was up to the director and the creator of the movies. But they did know that they loved the song The Way You Look Tonight. They loved those words of Dorothy Fields. Someday when I'm awfully low and the world is cold, I'll feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight. They loved those words over the scene when Steve Martin walks in and sees his daughter dancing with her new husband for the first time. And they wanted those words. And Frank Sinatra's version is swinging, you know? And they loved the words, but they wanted it to be a little more sentimental, the arrangement, because they wanted it to grab your heart. And so I went in as if I was working for the father of the bride, and he had given me that instructions, and we came up, Bob Mann and I, with this arrangement of The Way You Look Tonight. And I played it for them at the set. And I sang it on the demo for them to hear how it was going to go. And they said, who is that guy singing? I said, well, that's me. And they said, man, you got to be in the movie. So that was it. And that brought me back to the Great American Songbook. I was really the first standard I had ever sung since I was in high school singing At Last and stuff like that, you know.
Well, welcome back, Grammy Award-winning and Emmy-nominated music maker Steve Tyrell. His new CD, I'll Take Romance, from Concord Records, is out this week. Here's some of the title track with Judith Hill.
I'll take romance.
Ooh, baby, baby,
I'll take romance.
And this has been For Your Ears Only.
Time for one more news quote. Godzilla and Superman rolled into one. That was Dr. Ferdy Pacheco praising former colleague Angelo Dundee, the boxing trainer and corner man who famously guided and inspired Muhammad Ali, Sugar Ray Leonard, and other ring champions. Dundee died last week at 90.
For Your Ears Only On Air is online at YouTube, iTunes, and Podcast Bunker. But to continue, we need your tax-deductible donation. Please email davidearsonly@gmail.com to pledge.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan with intern Kaimana Larson. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern, acknowledging support from the nonprofit Gatewave Radio Reading Service, the century-old Carnegie Corporation of New York, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, and the Council on Hemispheric Affairs.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Kaimana Larson. With the Super Bowl in mind this week last year, we considered the problems of concussion and other traumatic brain injury among professional competitors and the high school athletes who revere them, from our February 6, 2011 broadcast, hosted by Melissa and David.
I'm all for player safety. I think it is the proper initiative that the National Football League has. I think we need to safeguard the men that play this game to the best of our abilities and make it as safe as we possibly can.
Standing up for tough safety regulations did not keep Coach Mike Tomlin from taking his Pittsburgh Steelers to this weekend's Super Bowl. But how much impact has the NFL's recent campaign to protect players and prevent concussions really made on those players and on youngsters following in their aggressive footsteps on school football fields and other amateur athletic battlegrounds from coast to coast?
Sports-related head injury numbers are out of control, with millions of concussions suffered by athletes every year, about 100,000 of them among high school players alone during the last school year. And while helmets do protect against skull fractures, the fact they don't provide much protection against brain trauma has grabbed the attention of Congress, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the NFL, and the media.
Kids playing all kinds of sports are at risk, and with little regulation, parents, politicians, and medical professionals are clamoring for something to be done. With us today to clear up some common misconceptions about brain injuries, For Your Ears Only, is injury attorney Michael V. Kaplan, currently chairperson of the New York State Traumatic Brain Injury Services Coordinating Council and past president of the Brain Injury Association of New York State. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You say traumatic brain injury, TBI, has reached epidemic levels in the U.S. What numbers are we looking at, and what conditions beyond concussion do they include?
We're looking at over 1 million individuals a year who are sustaining a traumatic brain injury, and it runs the spectrum from concussions all the way through individuals in a coma. It runs from returning service members from Iraq and Afghanistan to children injured in sports competitions with concussions, people, the elderly frequently being injured as a result of falls, young children frequently being injured as a result of falls, and our young adults frequently being injured in high-speed motor vehicle accidents.
Most people figure if you don't lose consciousness, you haven't suffered a concussion. Is that true?
That is a very common misconception when it comes to traumatic brain injury. The truth of the matter is that you do not need to sustain a loss of consciousness in order to sustain a concussion. It simply is not true. It's been long recognized as untrue by groups such as the American College of Neurological Surgeons, but yet it is a myth that still, unfortunately, is perpetuated in our society.
What are some of the signs of concussion, the degrees of severity, and what should one look out for?
That's an interesting question, because the signs and symptoms of concussion change as the condition progresses, and not everybody has the same signs and symptoms at the same time, and not everybody gets the same signs and symptoms. There are early warning signs of a concussion, generally speaking, headaches, nausea, dizziness, sensitivity to bright light, sensitivity to loud noises. There are later signs that develop, and frequently people don't know about this condition until they try to return to work and realize that they're just not the same. Their memory is off. Their concentration is off. When they attempt to get back up and do things, they find that they have become dizzy. They find that they're not sleeping the same at night. Some people sleep more. Some people sleep less. It's a very variable condition among different members of the population, and nobody can predict with a concussion what symptoms somebody will have.
With the Super Bowl still in mind, besides football, what sports and age groups are most vulnerable to the concussion problem?
Well, concussions and traumatic brain injury run the spectrum of all sports. Nobody involved in a sporting activity is immune from getting a traumatic brain injury. It doesn't matter if you're playing baseball and you have players running into each other at a base, or get hit by a ball, or get hit by a bat. It happens on the soccer field frequently with children running into each other, or even running into the goalpost. It is involved with ice skating, falling on the ice. It's involved frequently, one of the biggest areas where we find people, children sustaining a traumatic brain injury, interestingly enough, is cheerleading, where these cheerleaders fall and hit their heads. It goes on and on, from bicycle riding to rollerblading. It covers every conceivable sport. Children are at risk for a concussion in any sporting activity.
What are the biggest obstacles you see better safety policies coming up against?
Well, there are two aspects to this. One is recognition that a concussion has taken place and taking the proper steps to prevent future concussions from happening. Those are two important things that need to be known. When to keep a child out of play so that they sufficiently recover from the first concussion so that they don't go on to sustain another concussion while still healing from the first concussion. When to keep them away from vigorous activities in the classroom. While they're healing from that first concussion, you don't want to subject them to the stresses of schoolwork. You need time to allow that brain to heal. And just as important, when the brain doesn't heal, we need to get that child or adult, whoever it might be, into proper rehabilitation.
Do you see an increase in lawsuits against schools, helmet makers, coaches, others, if better safety measures and protective gear aren't forthcoming?
Yes, but it's not gear that I'm concerned about, because we can't protect a child from a concussion with a helmet. That is a misconception. That helmet might prevent against a skull fracture or other injuries to the skull and head, but it won't prevent the child from getting a concussion. So that the idea of making things safe, ideally, with helmets is not the answer to this problem. But lawsuits certainly will cause school districts, will cause school teams, will cause other professional teams to make sure that concussions are recognized, that individuals who have sustained a concussion are not allowed to return to play before they heal, and that individuals get the proper treatment that they are in need of once a concussion takes place.
Injury attorney Michael V. Kaplan is chairperson of the New York State Traumatic Brain Injury Services Coordinating Council and on the board of directors at the Brain Injury Association of New York State.
Safety and the Super Bowl from our February 6, 2011 broadcast. No new helmet standards have emerged since then. The National Football League remains the target of a dozen lawsuits charging it concealed information about head injuries, which apparently led the NFL to spend several million dollars on a Super Bowl commercial and website focused on player safety. The Defense Department, meanwhile, opened a high-tech traumatic brain injury department at its new billion-dollar hospital in Fort Belvoir, Virginia. I'm Kaimana Larson. We'll visit the archive again next week.
And this is David Alpern again with more from Steve Tyrell's CD, All of the Way You Look Tonight, as a tribute to New York's Oak Room Cabaret, where it also was featured at my wedding in 2007, and whose closing forever was announced last week. Its song may be ended, but all its melodies and my fond memories there linger on.
change. Keep that breakfast charm. Won't you please arrange it? 'Cause I love you just the way you look tonight. Just the way you look tonight.